it works," he said. "You have pleased me." This caused the three men to whisper in excitement and wave for their assistance. As they set up, a familiar figure wandered into Lightsong's ring of torches. Larimar wore his priestly robes, as always. Even when he was out in the city, which was where he should have been this night, he represented Lightsong and his priesthood. "Scoot?" Lightsong asked, sitting up. "Your grace," Larimar said, bowing. "Are you enjoying the festivities?" "Certainly. You might say I'm positively infested. But what are you doing here in the court? You should be out with your family."
"I just wanted to make certain everything was to your liking."
Lightsong rubbed his forehead.
"You're giving me a headache, Scoot."
"You can't get headaches, Your Grace."
"So you're fond of telling me," Lightsong said. "I assume the revelry outside the Holy Prison is nearly as amazing as what we have here inside?" Larimar frowned at Lightsong's dismissive reference to the divine compound.
"The party in the city is fantastic, Your Grace. T'Teller hasn't seen a festival this grand in decades."
"Then I repeat that you should be out enjoying it."
"I just..."
"Scoot," Lightsong said, giving the man a pointed look. "If there's one thing you can trust me to do completely on my own, it's enjoy myself. I will, I promise, in all solemnity, have a ravishingly good time drinking to excess and watching these nice men light things on fire. Now, go be with your family." Larimar paused, then stood, bowed, and withdrew.
"That man,"
Lightsong thought, sipping his fruity drink, "takes his work far too seriously." The concept amused Lightsong, and he leaned back, enjoying the fireworks. However, he was soon distracted by the approach of someone else. Or rather, one very important someone else, leading a group of far less important someone else's. Lightsong sipped his drink again. The newcomer was beautiful. She was a goddess, after all. Glossy black hair, pale skin, lushly curvaceous body. She wore far less clothing than Lightsong did, but that was typical of the court's goddesses. Her thin gown of green and silver silk was split on both sides, showing hips and thighs, and the neckline was draped so low that very little was left to the imagination. Blushweaver the Beautiful, Goddess of Honesty. "This should be interesting," Lightsong thought, smiling to himself. She was trailed by about 30 servants, not to mention her high priestess and 6 lesser priests. The firemasters grew excited, realizing that they now had not one but 2 divine observers. Their apprentices scurried about in a flurry of motion, setting up another series of fire fountains. A group of Blushweaver's servants rushed forward, carrying an ornate couch, which they set on the grass beside Lightsong. Blushweaver lay down with customary lithe grace, crossing perfect legs and resting on her side in a seductive yet ladylike pose. The orientation left her able to watch the fireworks should she wish, but her attention was obviously focused on Lightsong.
"My dear Lightsong," she said,
as a servant approached with a bunch of grapes.
"Aren't you even going to greet me?"
"Here we go," Lightsong thought. "My dear Blushweaver," he said, setting aside his cup and lacing his fingers before him, "why should I go and do something rude like that?"
"Rude?"
she asked, amused. "Of course. You obviously make quite a determined effort to draw attention to yourself. The details are magnificent, by the way. Is that makeup on your thighs?" She smiled, biting into a grape.
"It's a kind of paint. The designs were drawn by some of the most talented artists in my priesthood."
"My compliments to them," Lightsong said. "Regardless, you ask why I didn't greet you. Well, let us assume that I had acted as you suggest I should. Upon your approach, you would have had me gush over you?"
"Naturally."
You would have me point out how stunning you appear in that gown?
I wouldn't complain.
Mention how your dazzling eyes glisten in the fireworks like burning embers?
That would be nice.
Expound on how your lips are so perfectly red that they could leave any man breathless with wonder, yet drive him to compose the most brilliant of poetry each time he recalled the moment.
I'd be flattered for certain.
And you claim you want these reactions from me?
I do.
Well, blast it, woman, Light Song said, picking up his cup. If I'm stunned, dazzled, and breathless, then how the hell am I supposed to greet you? By definition, won't I be struck dumb?
She laughed. Well, then, you've obviously found your tongue now.
Surprisingly, it was in my mouth, he said. I always forget to check there.
But isn't that where it is expected to be?
My dear, he said, haven't you known me long enough to realize that my tongue, of all things, rarely does what it is expected to do?
Blushweaver smiled as the fireworks went off again. Within the auras of two gods, the sparks' colors grew quite powerful indeed. On the far side, some sparks fell to the ground too far from the breath auras, and these looked dull and weak in comparison, as if their fire were so cool and insignificant that they could be picked up and tucked away. Blushweaver turned from the display.
So you do find me beautiful?
Of course. Why, my dear, you're positively rank with beauty. You're literally part of the definition of the word. It's in your title somewhere, if I'm not mistaken.
My dear Light Song, I do believe that you're making sport of me.
I never make fun of ladies, Blushweaver, Light Song said, picking up his drink again. Mocking a woman is like drinking too much wine. It may be fun for a short time, but the hangover is hell.
Blushweaver paused. But we don't get hangovers, for we cannot get drunk.
We can't? Light Song asked, then why the blazes am I drinking all of this wine?
Blushweaver raised an eyebrow.
Sometimes, Light Song, she finally said, I'm not certain when you are being silly and when you're being serious. Well, I can help you with that one easily enough, he said. If you ever conclude that I'm being serious, then you can be sure that you've been working too hard on the problem.
I see, she said, twisting on her couch so that she was face down. She leaned on her elbows with breasts pushed up between them, fireworks playing off her exposed back and throwing colorful shadows between her arched shoulder blades.
So then, you admit that I'm stunning and beautiful. Would you then care to retire from the festivities this evening? Find other entertainments?
Light Song hesitated. Being unable to bear children didn't stop the gods from seeking intimacy, particularly with other returned. In fact, from what Light Song could guess, the impossibility of offspring only increased the laxness of the court in these matters. Many a god took mortal lovers. Blushweaver was known to have a few of her own among her priests. Dalliances with mortals were never seen as infidelity among the gods. Blushweaver lounged on her couch, supple, inviting. Light Song opened his mouth, but in his mind, he saw her, the woman of his vision, the one from his dreams, the face he'd mentioned to Larimar. Who was she?
Probably nothing, a flash from his former life, or perhaps simply an image crafted by his subconscious. Maybe even, as the priests claimed, some kind of prophetic symbol. That face shouldn't give him pause, not when confronted with perfection.
I must decline, he found himself saying. I need to watch the fireworks.
Are they that much more fascinating than I?
Not at all. They simply seem far less likely to burn me.
She laughed at that. Well, why don't we wait until they're through? Then retire.
Alas, Lightsong said, I still must decline. I am far too lazy.
Too lazy for sex?
Blushweaver asked, rolling back onto her side and regarding him. I'm really quite indolent, a poor example of a god, as I keep telling my high priest. Nobody seems to listen to me, so I fear that I must continue to be diligent in proving my point. Dallying with you would, unfortunately, undermine the entire basis of my argument. Blushweaver shook her head.
You confuse me sometimes, Lightsong. If it weren't for your reputation, I'd simply presume you to be shy. How could you have slept with Calmseer, but consistently ignore me?
Calmseer was the last honorable returned this city has known, Lightsong thought, sipping his drink. Nobody left has a shred of her decency, myself included. Blushweaver fell silent, watching the latest display from the Firemasters. The show had grown progressively more ornate, and Lightsong was considering calling a halt, lest they use up all of their fireworks on him and not have any left should another god call upon them. Blushweaver didn't make any move to return to her own palace grounds, and Lightsong said nothing further. He suspected that she hadn't come simply for verbal sparring, or even to try and bed him. Blushweaver always had her plans. In Lightsong's experience, there was more depth to the woman than her gaudy surface suggested. Eventually, his hunch paid off. She turned from the fireworks, eyeing the dark palace of the God King.
We have a new queen.
I noticed, Lightsong said, though, admittedly, only because I was reminded several times.
They fell silent. Have you no thoughts on the matter?
Blushweaver finally asked. I try to avoid having thoughts. They lead to other thoughts, and if you're not careful, those lead to actions. Actions make you tired. I have this on rather good authority from someone who once read it in a book. Blushweaver sighed.
You avoid thinking. You avoid me. You avoid effort. Is there anything you don't avoid?
Breakfast. Blushweaver didn't react to this, which Lightsong found disappointing. She was too focused on the king's palace. Lightsong usually tried to ignore the large black building. He didn't like how it seemed to loom over him.
Perhaps you should make an exception, Blushweaver said, and give some thought to this particular situation. This queen means something.
Lightsong turned his cup around in his fingers. He knew that Blushweaver's priests were among those who called most strongly for war in the court assembly. He hadn't forgotten his phantom nightmare from earlier, the vision of Teteller on fire. That image refused to fade from his mind. He never said anything for or against the idea of war. He just didn't want to be involved. We've had queens before, he finally said.
Never one of the royal line,
Blushweaver replied.
At least, there hasn't been one since the days of Kalad, the usurper.
Kalad, the man who had started the Many War, the one who had used his knowledge of biochromatic breath to create a vast army of lifeless and seize power in Halandrin. He had protected the kingdom with his armies, yet had shattered the kingdom as well by driving the royals into the highlands. Now they were back. Or at least one of them was.
This is a dangerous day, Lightsong,
Blushweaver said quietly.
What happens if that woman bears a child who isn't returned?
Impossible, Lightsong said.
Oh? You are that confident?
Lightsong nodded. Of the returned, only the God King can engender children, and they're always stillborn.
Blushweaver shook her head.
The only word we have for that is from the palace priests themselves. Yet I've heard of discrepancies in the records. Even if we don't worry about those, there are plenty of other considerations. Why do we need a royal to legitimize our throne? Isn't 300 years of rule by the court of God sufficient to make the kingdom legitimate?
Lightsong didn't respond.
This marriage implies that we still accept royal authority,
Blushweaver said.
What happens if that king up in the highlands decides to take his lands back? What happens if that queen of ours in there has a child by another man? Who is the heir? Who rules?
The God King rules. Everyone knows that.
He didn't rule 300 years ago,
Blushweaver said.
The royals did.
Then, after them, Kalad did. And after him, Peacegiver. Change can happen quickly. By inviting that woman into our city, we may have initiated the end of returned rule in Halandrin. She fell silent, pensive.
Lightsong studied the beautiful goddess.
It had been 15 years since her return, which made her old for a returned. Old, wise, and incredibly crafty.
Blushweaver glanced at him. I don't intend to find myself caught, surprised, like the royals were when Kalad seized their throne. Some of us are planning, Lightsong. You can join us, if you wish.
Politics, my dear, he said with a sigh. You know how I loathe it.
You're the god of bravery. We could use your confidence.
At this point, I'm only confident that I'll be of no use to you. Her face stiffened as she tried not to show her frustration. Eventually, she sighed and stood, stretching, showing off her perfect figure once more.
You'll have to stand for something eventually, Lightsong, she said. You're a god to these people.
Not by choice, my dear.
She smiled, then bent down and kissed him softly. Just consider what I said. You're a better man than you give yourself credit for being. You think I'd offer myself to just anyone?
He hesitated, then frowned. Actually, yes, I do. She laughed, turning as her servants picked up her couch.
Oh, come now. There must be at least 3 of the other gods I wouldn't think of letting touch me. Enjoy the party. And do try to imagine what our king is doing to our legacy up there in his chambers right now.
She glanced back at him.
Particularly if that imagining reminds you of what you just missed out on.
She winked, then glided away. Lightsong sat back on his couch, then dismissed the Firemasters with words of praise. As the minstrels began to play, he tried to empty his mind of both Blushweaver's ominous words and the visions of war that had plagued his dreams. He failed on both counts.
Chapter 8
Ciri groaned, rolling over. Her back hurt, her arms hurt, and her head hurt. In fact, she was so uncomfortable that she couldn't stay asleep, despite her fatigue. She sat up, holding her head. She'd spent the night on the floor of the God King's bedchamber, sleeping, kind of. Sunlight poured into the room, reflecting off of the marble where the floor wasn't covered with rugs. Black rugs, she thought, sitting in the middle of the rumpled blue dress, which she'd used as both blanket and pillow. Black rugs on a black floor with black furniture. These Halandrins certainly know how to run with a motif. The God King wasn't in the room. Ciri glanced toward the oversized black leather chair where he'd spent much of the night. She hadn't noticed him leave. She yawned, then rose, pulling her shift out of the wadded mound of dress and putting it on over her head. She pulled her hair out, flipping it behind her.
Keeping it so long was going to take some getting used to. It fell down against her back, a contented blonde in color. She'd somehow survived the night untouched. She walked on bare feet over to the leather chair, running her fingers along its smooth surface. She'd been less than respectful. She'd dozed off. She'd curled up and pulled her dress close. She'd even glanced over at the chair a few times. Not because of defiance or a disobedient heart. She'd simply been too drowsy to remember that she wasn't supposed to look at the God King. And he hadn't ordered her executed. Blue Fingers had made her worry that the God King was volatile and quick to anger. Yet if that was the case, then he had held his temper with her. What else was he going to do? The Halandrin had waited for decades to get a royal princess to marry into their line of God Kings. She smiled. I do have some power. He couldn't kill her. Not until he had what he wanted. It wasn't much, but it did give her a bit more confidence. She walked around the chair, noting its size. Everything in the room was built to be just a little too large, skewing her perspective, making her feel shorter than she was. She rested her hand on the arm of the chair and found herself wondering why he hadn't decided to take her. What was wrong with her? Wasn't she desirable? Foolish girl, she told herself, shaking her head and walking over to the still undisturbed bed. You spent most of the trip here worrying about what would happen on your wedding night, and then when nothing happens, you complain about that too? She knew she wasn't free. He would take her eventually. That was the point of the entire arrangement. But it hadn't happened last night. She smiled, yawning. Then she climbed up into the bed and curled up under the covers, drifting off. The next time she woke was a great deal more pleasant than the previous one had been. Ciri stretched and then noticed something. Her dress, which she'd left sitting in a heap on the floor, was gone. Also, the fire in the hearth had been rebuilt, though why that was necessary was beyond her. The day was warm, and she'd kicked off the covers as she'd slept. I'm supposed to burn the sheets, she remembered. That's the reason they stoked the fire. She sat up in her shift, alone in the black room. The servants and priests wouldn't know that she'd spent the entire night on the floor unless the God King had told someone. How likely would it be for a man of his power to speak with his priests about intimate details? Slowly, Ciri climbed out of bed and pulled the sheets free. She wadded them up, walked over, and threw them into the large hearth. Then she watched the flames. She still didn't know why the God King had left her alone. Until she knew, it was surely better to just let everyone assume that the marriage had been consummated. After the sheets were done burning, Ciri scanned the room, looking for something to wear. She found nothing. Sighing, she walked to the door, clothed only in her shift. She pulled it open and jumped slightly. 2 dozen serving women of varying ages knelt outside. God of colors, Ciri thought. How long have they been kneeling out here? Suddenly, she didn't feel quite so indignant at being forced to wait upon the God King's whims. The women stood up, heads bowed, and walked into the room. Ciri backed up, cocking her head when she noticed that several of the women carried in large chests. They're dressed in different colors from yesterday, Ciri thought. The cut was the same, divided skirts like flowing trousers, topped with sleeveless blouses and small caps, their hair coming out the back. Instead of the blue and silver, the outfits were now yellow and copper. The women opened the trunks, removing various layers of clothing. All were of bright colors, and each was of a different cut. The women spread them out on the floor before Ciri, then settled back on their knees, waiting. Ciri hesitated. She'd grown up the daughter of a king, so she'd never lacked. Yet life in Idris was austere.
She'd owned 5 dresses, which had nearly been an extravagant number. One had been white, and the other 4 had been the same wan blue. Being confronted by so many colors and options felt overwhelming. She tried to imagine how each would look on her. Many of them were dangerously low-cut, even more so than the shirts the serving women wore, and those were already scandalous by Idrian standards. Finally, hesitantly, Ciri pointed at one outfit. It was a dress in 2 pieces, red skirt and matching blouse. As Ciri pointed, the serving women stood, some putting away the unchosen outfits, others walking over to carefully remove Ciri's shift. In a few minutes, Ciri was dressed. She was embarrassed to find that while the clothing fit her perfectly, the blouse was designed to reveal her midriff. Still, it wasn't as low-cut as the others, and the skirt went all the way down to her calves. The silky red material was far lighter than the thick wools and linens she was accustomed to wearing. The skirt flared and ruffled when she turned, and Ciri couldn't be completely certain it wasn't sheer. Standing in it, she almost felt as naked as she'd been during the night. "That appears to be a recurring theme for me here," she thought wryly as the serving women backed away. Others approached with a stool, and she sat, waiting as the women cleaned her face and arms with a pleasantly warm cloth. When that was done, they reapplied her makeup, did her hair, then sprayed her with a few puffs of perfume. When she opened her eyes, perfume misting down around her, Blue Fingers was standing in the room. "Ah, excellent," he said, servant boy standing obediently behind with ink, quill, and paper. "You're up already." "Already?" Ciri thought. "It has to be well past noon." Blue Fingers looked her over, nodded to himself, then glanced at the bed, obviously checking to see that the linens had been destroyed. "Well," he said, "I trust that your servants will see to your needs, Vessel." With that, he began to walk away with the anxious tread of a man who felt he had far too much to do. "Wait," Ciri said, standing, jostling several of her serving women. Blue Fingers hesitated. "Vessel?" Ciri floundered, uncertain how to express what she was feeling. "Do you know what I'm supposed to do?"
"Do, Vessel?" the scribe asked. "You mean in regards to..."
He glanced at the bed. Ciri flushed. "No, not that. I mean with my time. What are my duties? What is expected of me?"
"To provide an heir."
"Beyond that?" Blue Fingers frowned.
Well, to be honest, Vessel, I really don't know. I must say your arrival has certainly caused a level of disruption in the Court of Gods."
"In my life, too," she thought, flushing slightly, hair turning red.
"Not that you're to blame, of course," Blue Fingers said quickly. "But then, well, I certainly wish I'd had more forewarning."
"More forewarning?" Ciri asked. "This marriage was arranged by treaty over 20 years ago."
"Yes, well, but nobody thought..."
He trailed off.
"Well, either way, we shall do our best to accommodate you here in the king's palace."
What was that? Ciri thought. Nobody thought that the marriage would really happen? Why not? Did they assume that Idris wouldn't keep its part of the bargain? Regardless, he still hadn't answered her question. "Yes, but what am I supposed to do?" she said, sitting down on the stool again. "Am I to sit here in the palace and stare at the fire all day?" Blue Fingers chuckled.
"Oh, colors, no. My lady, this is the Court of Gods. You'll find plenty to occupy you. Each day, performers are allowed to enter the court and display their talents for their deities. You may have any of these brought to you for a private performance."
"Ah," Ciri said. "Can I maybe go horseback riding?" Blue Fingers rubbed his chin. I suppose we could bring some horses into the court for you. Of course, we'd have to wait until the wedding jubilation is over.
Wedding jubilation? She asked.
You don't know, then? Were you not prepared for any of this?
Ciri flushed.
No offense intended, Vessel, Bluefinger said. The wedding jubilation is a week-long period in which we celebrate the God King's marriage. During that time, you are not to leave this palace. At the end of it, you will officially be presented to the Court of Gods.
Oh, she said. And after that, I can go out of the city?
Out of the city? Bluefinger said. Vessel, you can't leave the Court of Gods.
What?
You may not be a god yourself, Bluefingers continued, but you're the wife of the God King. It would be far too dangerous to let you out. But don't fret. Anything and everything you might request can be provided for you.
Except freedom, she thought, feeling a bit sick.
I assure you, once the wedding jubilation is over, you will find little to complain about. Everything you could want is here. Every type of indulgence, every luxury, every diversion.
Ciri nodded numbly, still feeling trapped.
Also, Bluefinger said, holding up an ink-stained finger, if you wish, the court assembly meets to provide decisions to the people. Full assembly meets once a week, though daily there are smaller judgments to be made. You aren't to sit on the assembly itself, of course, but you will certainly be allowed to attend once the jubilation is over. If none of this suits you, you may request an artist of the God King's priesthood to attend you. His priests include devout and accomplished artists from all genres: music, painting, dance, poetry, sculpture, puppetry, play performance, sand painting, or any of the lesser genres.
Ciri blinked. God of colors, she thought. Even being idle is daunting here.
But there isn't any of this that I'm required to attend? No, I shouldn't think so, Bluefinger said. Vessel, you look displeased.
How could she explain? Her entire life she'd been expected to be something, and for most of her life she'd intentionally avoided being it. Now that was gone from her. She couldn't disobey, lest she get herself killed and get Idris into a war. For once, she was willing to serve, to try and be obedient. But, ironically, there didn't seem to be anything for her to do, except, of course, bear a child.
Very well, she said with a sigh. Where are my rooms? I'll go there and situate myself. Your rooms, Vessel?
Yes.
I assume I'm not to reside in this chamber itself.
No,
Bluefinger said, chuckling. The conception room? Of course not.
Then where? Ciri asked.
Vessel, Bluefinger said, in a way, this entire palace is yours. I don't see why you'd need specific rooms. Ask to eat, and your servants will set up a table. If you wish to rest, they will bring you a couch or a chair. Seek entertainment, and they will fetch performers for you.
Suddenly, the strange actions of her servants, simply bringing her an array of colors to choose from, then doing her makeup and hair right there, made more sense.
I see, she said, almost to herself.
And the soldiers I brought with me? Did they do as I commanded?
Yes, Vessel, Bluefinger said. They left this morning. It was a wise decision. They are not dedicated servants of the Tones, and wouldn't have been allowed to remain here in the court. They could do you no further service.
Ciri nodded.
Vessel, if I might be excused? Bluefingers asked.
Ciri nodded distractedly, and Bluefingers bustled away, leaving her to think about how terribly alone she was.
Can't focus on that, she thought. Instead, she turned to one of her serving women, a younger one, about Ciri's own age. Well, that really doesn't tell me what to spend my time on, does it? The servant blushed quietly, bowing her head. I mean, there seems to be a lot to do if I want, Ciri said. Maybe too much. The girl bowed again.
That's going to get very annoying very quickly, Ciri thought, gritting her teeth.
Part of her wanted to do something shocking to get a reaction out of the servant, but she knew she was just being foolish. In fact, it seemed that many of her natural impulses and reactions wouldn't work here in Hallandren. So, to keep herself from doing something silly, Ciri stood up, determined to examine her new home. She left the overly black room, poking her head out into the hallway. She turned back to her servants, who stood obediently in a line behind her. "Is there any place I'm forbidden to go?" she asked. The one she was addressing shook her head.
"Fine, then," she thought. "I'd better not end up stumbling upon the God King in the bath."
She crossed the hallway, opened the door, then stepped into the yellow room she'd been in the day before. The chair and bench she'd used had been removed, replaced by a group of yellow couches. Ciri raised an eyebrow, then walked through into the tub room beyond. The tub was gone. She started. The room was the one she remembered, with the same red colorings. Yet the sloped tile platforms with their inset tubs were gone. The entire contraption must have been portable, brought in for her bath, then removed.
They really can transform any room, she thought with amazement. They must have chambers full of furniture, tubs, and drapings, each of a different color, waiting upon the whims of their god.
Curious, she left the tubless room and moved in a random direction. Each room appeared to have four doors, one on each wall. Some rooms were larger than others. Some had windows to the outside, while others were in the middle of the palace. Each was a different color, yet it was still difficult to tell the difference between them. Endless rooms, pristine with their decorations following a single color's theme. Soon, she was hopelessly lost, but it didn't seem to matter. Every room was, in a way, the same as any other. She turned to her servants. "I would like breakfast." It happened far faster than Ciri would have thought possible. Several of the women ducked out and returned with a stuffed green chair to match her current room. Ciri sat down, waiting as a table, chairs, and finally food were produced as if out of nowhere. In less than 15 minutes, she had a hot meal waiting for her. Hesitantly, she picked up a fork and tried a bite. It wasn't until that moment that she realized how hungry she was. The meal was composed primarily of a group of sausages mixed with vegetables. The flavors were far stronger than she was accustomed to. However, the more she ate the spicy Hallandren food, the more she found herself liking it. Hungry or not, it was strange to eat in silence. Ciri was accustomed to either eating in the kitchens with the servants or at the table with her father, his generals, and whatever local people or monks he had invited to his home that evening. It was never a silent affair. Yet here in Hallandren, land of colors, sounds, and ostentation, she found herself eating alone, quietly, in a room that felt dull despite its bright decorations. Her servants watched. None of them spoke to her. Their silence was supposed to be respectful, she knew, but Ciri just found it intimidating. She tried several times to draw them into conversation, but she managed to get only terse replies. She chewed on a spiced caper. "Is this what my life is to be from now on?" she thought. "A night spent feeling half-used, half-ignored by my husband, then days spent surrounded by people, yet somehow still alone?" She shivered, her appetite waning. She set down the fork, and her food slowly grew cold on the table before her. She stared at it, a part of her wishing she'd simply remained in the comfortable, oversized black bed.
Chapter 9.
Vivenna, firstborn child of Dedelin, king of Idris, gazed upon the grand city of Teteller. It was the ugliest place she had ever seen. People jostled their way through the streets, draped flagrantly in colors, yelling and talking and moving and stinking and coughing and bumping. Her hair lightened to gray. She pulled her shawl close as she maintained her imitation, such that it was, of an elderly woman. She had feared that she might stand out. She needn't have worried. Who could ever stand out in this confusion? Nevertheless, it was best to be safe. She had come, arriving in Teteller just hours ago, to rescue her sister, not to get herself kidnapped. It was a bold plan. Vivenna could hardly believe that she'd come up with it. Still, of the many things her tutors had taught her, one was foremost in her mind. A leader was someone who acted. Nobody else was going to help Ciri, and so it was up to Vivenna. She knew that she was inexperienced. She hoped that her awareness of that would keep her from being too foolhardy, but she had the best education and political tutelage her kingdom could provide, and much of her training had focused on life in Halandrin. As a devout daughter of Ostra, she'd practiced all of her life to avoid standing out. She could hide in a vast, disorganized city, like Teteller. And vast it was. She'd memorized maps, but they hadn't prepared her for the sight, sound, scent, and colors of the city on market day. Even the livestock wore bright ribbons. Vivenna stood at the side of the road, stooped beside a building draped in flapping streamers. In front of her, a herdsman drove a small flock of sheep toward the market square. They had each been dyed a different color. "Won't that ruin the wool?" Vivenna thought sourly. The different colors on the animals clashed so terribly that she had to look away. "Poor Ciri," she thought, "caught up in all of this. Locked in the court of gods, probably so overwhelmed that she can barely think." Vivenna had been trained to deal with the terrors of Halandrin. Though the colors sickened her, she had the fortitude to withstand them. How would little Ciri manage? Vivenna tapped her foot as she stood beside the building in the shadow of a large stone statue. "Where is that man?" she thought. Parlin had yet to return from his scouting. There was nothing to do but wait. She glanced up at the statue beside her. It was one of the famous Dedenir Celebrin. Most of the statues depicted warriors. They stood in every imaginable pose all across the entire city, armed with weapons and often dressed in colorful clothing. According to her lessons, the people of Teteller found dressing the statues to be an amusing pastime. Lore had it that the first ones had been commissioned by Peacegiver, the Blessed, the returned who had taken command of Halandrin at the end of the Many War. The number of statues had increased each year as new ones were paid for by the returned, whose money, of course, came from the people themselves. Excess and waste, Vivenna thought, shaking her head. Finally, she noticed Parlin coming back down the street. She frowned as she saw that he was wearing some ridiculous frippery on his head. It looked a little like a sock, though much larger. The bright green hat flopped down one side of his square face and looked very out of place against his dull brown Idrian travel clothing. Tall, but not lanky, Parlin was only a few years Vivenna's senior. She'd known him for most of her life. General Yarda's son had practically grown up in the palace. More recently, he'd been out in the forests, watching the Halandrin border or guarding one of the northern passes. "Parlin," she said as he approached, carefully keeping the annoyance out of her voice and her hair, "what is that on your head?"
"A hat," he said, characteristically terse.
It wasn't that Parlin was rude. It just seemed he rarely felt he had much to say.
"I can see that it's a hat, Parlin. Where did you get it?"
"The man in the market said they're very popular."
Vivenna sighed. She hesitated to bring Parlin into the city. He was a good man, as solid and reliable as she'd ever known. But the life he knew was one of living in the wilderness and guarding isolated outposts. The city was probably overwhelming to him.
"The hat is ridiculous, Parlin," Vivenna said, hair controlled to keep the red out of it, "and makes you stand out."
Parlin removed the hat, tucking it in his pocket. He said nothing further, but did turn, watching the crowds of people pass. They seemed to make him as nervous as they did Vivenna, perhaps more so. However, she was glad to have him. He was one of the few people she trusted not to go to her father. She knew that Parlin fancied her. During their youth, he'd often brought her gifts from the forest. Usually those had taken the form of some animal he'd killed. To Parlin's mind, nothing showed affection like a hunk of something dead and bleeding on the table.
"This place is strange," Parlin said. "People here move like herds."
His eyes followed a pretty Hallandrin girl as she walked by. The hussy was, like most of the women in Teteller, wearing practically nothing. Blouses that were open well below the neck, skirts well above the knees. Some women even wore trousers, just like men.
"What did you discover in the market?" she asked, drawing his attention back.
"There are a lot of Idrians here," he said.
"What?"
Vivenna said, forgetting herself and showing her shock.
"Idrians," Parlin said, "in the market. Some were trading goods. Many looked like common laborers. I watched them."
Vivenna frowned, folding her arms.
"And the restaurant?" Vivenna asked. "Did you scout it, as I asked?"
He nodded. "Looks clean. Feels strange to me that people eat food made by strangers."
"Did you see anyone suspicious there?"
"What would be suspicious in this city?"
"I don't know. You're the one who insisted on scouting ahead."
"It's always a good idea when hunting. Less likely to scare away the animals."
"Unfortunately, Parlin," Vivenna said, "people aren't like animals."
"I am aware of that," Parlin said. "Animals make sense."
Vivenna sighed. However, she did notice just then that Parlin had been right on at least one count. She caught sight of a group of Idrians walking along the street nearby, one pulling a cart that had probably once held produce. They were easy to distinguish by their muted dress and the slight accent to their voices. It surprised her that they would come so far to trade. But admittedly, commerce hadn't been particularly robust in Idris lately. Reluctantly, she closed her eyes and, using the shawl to hide the transformation, changed her hair from gray to brown. If there were other Idrians in town, it was unlikely that she would stand out. Trying to act like an old woman would be more suspicious. It still felt wrong to be exposed. In Bavalis, she'd have been recognized instantly. Of course, Bavalis had only a few thousand people in it. The vastly greater scale of Teteller would require a conscious adjustment. She gestured to Parlin, and gritting her teeth, joined the crowd and began making her way toward the marketplace. The inland sea made all the difference. Teteller was a prime port, and the dyes it sold, made from the tears of Edgeley, a local flower, made it a center of trade. She could see the evidence all around her. Exotic silks and clothing. Brown-skinned traders from Tedradel with their long black beards bound with tight leather cords into cylindrical shapes. Fresh foodstuffs from cities along the coast. In Idris, the population was spread out thinly across the farms and rangelands. In Hallandrin, a country that controlled a good third of the inland sea's coast, things were different. They could burgeon, grow, get flamboyant. In the distance, she could see the plateau that held the Court of Gods, the most profane place beneath Ostra's colorful eyes. Inside its walls, within the God King's terrible palace, Ciri was being held captive, prisoner of Sesebrun himself. Logically, Vivenna understood her father's decision. In raw political terms, Vivenna was more valuable to Idris. If war was certain, it made sense to send the less useful daughter as a stalling tactic. But it was hard for Vivenna to think of Ciri as less useful. She was gregarious, but she'd also been the one who smiled when others were down. She was the one who brought gifts when nobody was expecting them. She was infuriating, but also innocent. She was Vivenna's baby sister, and someone had to look out for her. The God King would demand an heir. That was to have been Vivenna's duty, her sacrifice for her people. She had been prepared and willing. It felt wrong for Ciri to have to do something so terrible. Her father had made his decision, the best one for Idris. Vivenna had made her own. If there was going to be a war, then Vivenna wanted to be ready to get her sister out of the city the moment it got dangerous. In fact, Vivenna felt there had to be a way to rescue Ciri before the war came, a way of fooling the Halandrin, making them think that Ciri had died. Something that would save Vivenna's sister, yet not further provoke hostilities. This wasn't something her father could condone, so she hadn't told him. Better for him to be able to deny involvement if things went wrong. Vivenna moved down the street, eyes downcast, careful to not draw attention to herself. Getting away from Idris had been surprisingly easy. Who would suspect such a brash move from Vivenna? She who had always been perfect. Nobody wondered when she'd asked for food and supplies, explaining that she wanted to make emergency kits. Nobody questioned when she'd proposed an expedition to the higher reaches to gather important roots, an excuse to disguise the first few weeks of her disappearance. Parlin had been easy enough to persuade. He trusted her, perhaps too much, and he had intimate knowledge of the paths and trails leading down to Halandrin. He'd been as far as the city walls on one scouting trip a year back. With his help, she'd been able to recruit a few of his friends, also woodsmen, to protect her and be part of her expedition. She'd sent the rest of them back earlier that morning. They would be of little use in the city, where she had already arranged for other allies to be her protection. Parlin's friends would carry word to her father, who would already have heard of what she'd done. Before leaving, she'd arranged for her maid to deliver a letter to him. Counting off the days, she realized that her letter would be delivered that very evening. She didn't know what her father's reaction would be. Perhaps he would covertly send soldiers to retrieve her. Perhaps he'd leave her be. She'd warned him that if she saw Idrian soldiers searching for her, she would simply go to the Court of Gods, explain that there had been a mistake, and trade herself for her sister. She sincerely hoped she wouldn't have to do that. The God King wasn't to be trusted. He might take Vivenna captive and keep Ciri, thereby gaining two princesses to provide pleasure instead of one. "Don't think about that," Vivenna told herself, pulling her shawl closer despite the heat. Better to find another way. The first step was to find Lemix, her father's chief spy in Halandrin. Vivenna had corresponded with him on several occasions. Her father had wanted her to be familiar with his best intelligence agent in Teteller, and his foresight would work against him. Lemix knew Vivenna and had been told to take orders from her. She'd sent the spy a letter, delivered via a messenger, with multiple mounts to allow quick delivery, the day she'd left Idris. Assuming the message had arrived safely, the spy would meet her in the appointed restaurant. Her plan seemed good. She was prepared. Why, then,
did she feel so utterly daunted when she entered the market. She stood quietly, a rock in the stream of human traffic flooding down the street. It was such an enormous expanse, covered in tents, pens, buildings, and people. There were no cobblestones here, only sand and dirt with the occasional patch of grass, and there didn't appear to be much reason or direction to the arrangement of buildings. The arbitrary streets had simply been made where people felt like going. Merchants yelled out what they sold, banners waved in the wind, and entertainers vied for attention. It was an orgy of color and motion.
"Wow,"
Parlin said quietly. Vivenna turned, shaking off her stupor.
"Weren't you just here?"
"Yeah," Parlin said, eyes a little glazed over.
"Wow again."
Vivenna shook her head.
"Let's go to the restaurant."
Parlin nodded.
"This way."
Vivenna followed him, annoyed. This was Hallandrin. She shouldn't be awed by it. She should be disgusted. Yet she was so overwhelmed that it was hard to feel anything beyond a slight sense of sickness. She'd never realized how much she took Idris's beautiful simplicity for granted. Parlin's familiar presence was welcome as the powerful wave of scents, sounds, and sights tried to drown her. In some places, the crowds grew so thick that they had to shove their way through. On occasion, Vivenna found herself on the edge of panic, pressed in by dirty, repulsively colored bodies. Blessedly, the restaurant wasn't too far in, and they arrived just when she thought the sheer excess of the place would make her scream. On its signboard out front, the restaurant had a picture of a boat sailing merrily. If the scents coming from inside were any indication, then the ship represented the restaurant's cuisine. Fish. Vivenna barely kept herself from gagging. She'd eaten fish several times in preparation for her life in Hallandrin. She'd never grown to like it. Parlin walked in, immediately stepping to the side and crouching, almost like a wolf, as he let his eyes adjust to the dimness. Vivenna gave the restaurant keeper the fake name Lemix knew to call her by. The restaurant keeper eyed Parlin, then shrugged and led the two of them to one of the tables on the far side of the room. Vivenna sat down. Despite her training, she was a little uncertain what one did at a restaurant. It seemed significant to her that places like restaurants could exist in Hallandrin, places meant to feed not travelers, but the locals, who couldn't be bothered to prepare their own food and dine at their own homes. Parlin didn't sit, but remained standing beside her chair, watching the room. He looked as tense as she felt.
"Vivenna,"
he said softly, leaning down,
"your hair."
She started, realizing that her hair had lightened from the trauma of pushing her way through the crowd. It hadn't bleached completely white. She was far too well trained for that. But it had grown whiter, as if it had been powdered. Feeling a jolt of paranoia, Vivenna replaced the shawl on her head, looking away as the restaurant owner approached to take their order. A short list of meals was scratched into the table, and Parlin finally sat down, drawing the restaurant owner's attention away from Vivenna.
"You're better than this," she told herself sternly. "You've studied Hallandrin for most of your life."
Her hair darkened, returning to its brown. The change was subtle enough that if someone had been watching, they would have probably thought it to be a trick of the light. She kept the shawl up, feeling ashamed. One walk through the market, and she lost control.
"Think of Ciri," she told herself. That gave her strength.
Her mission was impromptu, even reckless, but it was important. Calm once again, she put the shawl back down and waited while Parlin chose a dish, a seafood stew, and the innkeeper walked away.
"Now what?" Parlin asked. "We wait," Vivenna said. "In my letter, I told Lemix to check the restaurant each day at noon. We will sit here until he arrives."
Parlin nodded, fidgeting.
"What is it?"
Vivenna asked calmly.
He glanced toward the door. I don't trust this place, Vivenna. I can't smell anything but bodies and spices. Can't hear anything but the chatter of people.